Welcome to the Deeper Look podcast for Restoration Church. Each week, we're going to take the passage we're looking at on Sunday and ask questions and go deeper in conversation than we would normally have time to in a gathering. We're asking four big questions. What does this tell us about God? What does this tell us about ourselves? How does this help us love our neighbor? And how can we put this into practice? We're following along the narrative lectionary that's taking us from creation to Pentecost, the full redemptive narrative of Scripture. You can find resources, Bible reading plans at restorationlex.com/restoried. Again, thanks so much for listening. Here we go. Hola, my friends. Hello, welcome to Deeper Look Podcast. And as always, I'm Justin. And as always, that's Caleb.
Caleb, hey guys.
And as you hopefully know by now, we take the passages from the narrative lectionary from our restored journey at Restoration, and we go deeper than we would have time to on a Sunday morning. And we're trying to make Sunday and home church gathering videos shorter, so that, you know, they're more like a resource for our home churches instead of being full-length sermons. So we got so much to talk about for these passages. And that's true for today as we move into Daniel chapter 6, a story that, like others that we have been in, were popular kids' stories, but now as you get into them in adulthood, they have quite a lot more meaning and different meaning than you ever could imagine as a child. So Caleb, tell us about Daniel chapter 6. What's happening?
Daniel chapter 6. It follows Daniel chapter 5. And Daniel chapter 5 follows Daniel chapter 4. What do you want to know about chapter 6?
Okay, what commentary is that in? Is that in?
Oh, I know, right? That's in Caleb's commentary of obvious facts. Yeah, so we've got Daniel, and he's essentially one of the highest advisors under a guy named King Darius, and one of the most trusted officials, and Darius just really relies on him. But there is a problem. They're living in a land of exile, and Daniel is Jewish. He's not Medes or Persian. So that causes all the other high officials of the area to, he gets under their skin. He doesn't like them because he's an outsider. There's no reason he should be advising the king. He was this foreigner kind of brought into the area against his will. And his story is a lot like Joseph's, actually, where Joseph gets taken down to Egypt and becomes one of the royal advisors, if you will. So that's kind of the setting for this particular story. And all of these people, these high officials, it says, I think 120 of them, all apparently come together as one, and they start plotting against Daniel. And it's important to note that this was a very malicious thing against Daniel. This wasn't just a thing that all these people were trying to do because they thought it was a good idea. They didn't like Daniel. So they come together and convince the king to sign an order that if anyone prays to any god or any human that is not King Darius, then they should be thrown into the lion's pit. They should be thrown into the lion's den. And of course, Darius signs off on it, not thinking about it. I'm like, yeah, sounds good, great. There's a lot of scholarship that even suggests that he probably wasn't even thinking about Daniel at that time or thinking about the Jews. The order was supposed to go out to the Medes and Persians, but because Daniel was in the highest courts officially, or in this particular story, the law applied to him. So Daniel gets wind of all this because he's obviously in the highest of all authority under King Darius. And he goes to his window and decides to pray anyway. And one of the really interesting questions to ask about this story, or to note in this story, is that Daniel thought praying to God was worth his life. And we can circle back around to that, but thinking that prayer is worth your life, that's what Daniel's doing in this moment. He thinks prayer is worth his life. The officials see it. They run back to King Darius and say, hey, Daniel's broken the law. You need to throw him into the lion pit. Darius kind of frets the rest of the day trying to figure out, how am I going to get Daniel out of this? But the officials, these 120 individuals, they keep pressing. And eventually Darius throws Daniel into the lion's den, into the lion's pit, and says, "May God be with you." And the pit was actually, if you can imagine, just this big hole in the ground that these starving lions stayed in, and there was a hole that you could roll a rock over on top of the ground. So they do that. They put the king's signature on it, the official signature on it, and Daniel was thrown in there. Next morning, King Darius comes out. "Daniel, are you still alive?" And who knows if Daniel is being sarcastic or if he means it. There's just no way of knowing by reading the text. But he says, "Long live the king." So he lives. And that's generally where our kids' version of the story ends. The adult version is King Darius takes those 120 individuals and their wives and their children, and he throws them into the pit, and the lions devour them. So that's the not kid friendly version of this particular story. It's pretty dark. You're throwing entire families into this pit, probably because you don't want people to rise against you and come after you for vengeance. So you take out their wives and their kids too. And then Darius at the very end of the story says, Medes and Persians tremble before the God of Daniel because he performs miracles and he performs wonders in the world, and even acknowledges that even though he's a king himself or in this kingly authority, he acknowledges that God's kingdom will last eternally and that God is the ultimate king. So it's kind of a weird turn of events from the very beginning of the story. But that's the story in a nutshell.
Yeah, that's great. And even more background with that, with Daniel. I mean, this was late 7th century BC, early 6th century BC, when Babylon comes and conquers and carries the Jewish people, the elites, the leaders, the upper class back to Babylon. That's a 2-month journey. And there's estimates of 48,000 people that left, that were taken as captives. And that was an 80-year stay. And so Daniel's taking place, the story's taking place within that context. And so these folks have had their temple destroyed. They've had their identity ripped away. And the purpose of bringing them back to Babylon is to recapitulate them, to shape them into, you know, Babylonian people.
Babylonians, yeah.
Keep that kind of former identity, former religion, everything that, you know, they knew as their own identity, and to take that away and to make them something very, very different. And so Daniel really is a story about that, about how do we remain faithful in the midst of empire when everyone around us is calling us to a different way of living. They're trying to bring us into another way. Jeremiah 29, 4-7 is a good companion verses for this story in particular, because it reminds you that God's call from Jeremiah in these moments was not to hole up and try to stay away, not to fight, but to plant gardens and have families, to settle in and to seek the wholeness, the shalom of the city they're in Babylon, and to grow, basically, to trust that God will be with them in this season. And Daniel, the whole book of Daniel is about that process of being faithful to God in the midst of empire in a world that is trying to take away your identity and your faith, but staying strong. So
yeah, and it's not just for some of our anti-empire revolutionaries today. It's not just because they're anti-establishment. Yeah. It's because the empire is hostile, like hostile. So it's important to note that too. I mean, I was reading something last night that I think it was on Slate.com of all places. Wow. I know, right? Like, that's a weird thing to be reading about Daniel, but that's where I found it. And the author was saying that Daniel is really almost like a manual or a guidebook of what it means to be faithful, like you said, or to live in a hostile world. How do you carry yourself and continue, not just carry yourself, but like, how do you thrive? Not just survive, but how do you thrive in a hostile world? Yeah.
And I've read too this week that, you know, it's set in the 6th century. You know, many scholars think it was written in the 6th century, but those who don't, many of them think it was written in the 2nd century, when this was also an issue for Israel. They were in a Hellenistic world that was trying to pull them away from their identity and faith, and over and over again. I mean, this is a source of trying times in generation after generation. It's a question, a reality that every generation of people of faith have to face, is how do we live in the world as people who seek the shalom, seek the wholeness and prosperity, but yet be distinct, be the people of God, be set apart, and hold on to our identity, hold on to our faith, and be who God's called us to be, live in that tension. And, you know, we're obviously, even now in our modern America, we're living in that tension of how we can be set apart in the midst of our own sense of empire here in America, and the voices and allegiances that call out. And like you said, it's not just a government sort of thing. There are other, you know, institutions, empires, powers that are calling out for us to believe them, to live into their sense of seeing the world, their identity, and reshape who we are. And this book's all about remaining faithful.
Yeah, and hostile to us when we don't live into those. Yeah, it's, if there were ever a book for our current time in the world, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's, I had a conversation one time, it reminded me of this. We went through the book of Daniel a year or two ago here at Restoration, and that the question I asked is, do you see America more as an Israel or as a Babylon? And I know that neither one are a perfect, you know, metaphor for the moment we're in. There's ways, but America is, in and of itself, is an empire. It is a way of interpreting our times that help us understand ourselves as exiles, that we are not, this is not our home. This is not, you know, America is not the deepest sense of our identity. We are foreigners and strangers, as 1 Peter tells us in 1 Peter chapter 2. We are exiles and a holy nation, a royal priesthood, here in this world, set apart. And so to see ourselves in this moment, not as Americans who happen to be Christians, but Christians who happen to be Americans and have a deeper identity than even the country and the culture that we find ourselves in. It's shaped far, far more by what Jesus is shaping in us than what the world around us is trying to form us to be. So like you said, so important for where we're at right now. The book of Daniel is as timely as just about anything we've gone into in this whole restored journey. So
yeah, and we're moving into a season of Advent where we're waiting on Christ the King. That's kind of the church calendar right now for those of us that kind of keep track with a church calendar. And Daniel might seem like a weird text for Advent, but it's almost like the perfect text. It's the moment when it's darkest. It's the moment when you really need God to show up. And God showed up in a big way in this particular story. And it kind of points us towards the end of December, when we'll be celebrating the birth of Christ. So it's a timely story. It's a time to go ahead and start preparing ourselves of recognizing, yeah, there is darkness surrounding us, but no, it's not going to overcome us. Christ is on the way, and I think we should keep that like at the forefront of our minds this particular week.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, the prayer or the decree really of Darius sounds so much like the prophecies coming Messiah. Similar language, his kingdom will endure forever. And it's in a way a prophecy of the coming king who we've been, you know, looking forward to throughout this journey. It's about to come in Advent. And so you're right on with that.
So what's it tell us about? Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Hey, we had the same thought at the same time here.
Right? I know. I guess it's time for a transition.
Yeah, transition time. Let's see. This is where we swipe over on the screen, but we don't have those abilities, so we'll just go into it. We asked 4 questions. What does this say about God? What does this say about ourselves? How does this help us love our neighbor? And how can we put this into practice? So first question, I'll give it to you as you pour out of that Chemex some coffee there.
I've had this thing forever and I haven't gone, I really just want to go get a coffee pot that like it's one of those old fashioned drip pots, to be honest with you, because that thing's a pain.
Yeah, but it takes a long time. Yeah.
But it works.
And I wanted to say, what does this say about God? What's the story reveal to us about God's character?
Yeah, so I've been thinking about this particular question, and really kind of where I've landed is, what does Daniel think about God as a way to answer this question? Yeah, God performs miracles, okay, but what does Daniel think about who God is in this particular story? Kind of a more nuanced way of looking at it. And kind of like I said at the beginning, Daniel thought prayer to God was worth his life. He knew when he started praying to God that he was going to get thrown into a pit and that could very well be the end of him. And he thought it was worth it. And you have to ask yourself, okay, dying by lions is not the way that you want to go out. That would be absolutely terrible. If you've ever been bitten by an animal, you know how bad it hurts to get bitten by an animal. Torn apart, come on now. Like it's going to be bad, but Daniel thought praying to God was worth it. Why? Who did he think that God was? And I think there are a few things that we can kind of point to. There's actually later in Daniel chapter 12, I believe, Daniel kind of alludes to the resurrection. He kind of talks about God bringing people back. And you kind of see this theme play out in the Old Testament and obviously in the New Testament as well. So Daniel either thought God was going to work a miracle, thought that no matter what happened to him, God was going to take care of him, whether it was in this life or the next. But he thought God was greater than all of it. Like he was willing to go to the lions, to face off with the lions, knowing that no matter what happened, in the end, he was going to be okay because he's going to be with God in some form or fashion. And the really interesting thing to me about this story, speaking of lions, and just kind of what it says about who God is, we often talk about the lions in the den themselves and God rescuing Daniel from those particular lions. But the high officials, they were lions literally sitting outside Daniel's window waiting for the moment to strike. That's what they were doing. They set up a trap. I mean, lions, they set up traps to capture their prey out in the wild, right? These people are setting up a trap for Daniel and just waiting for the moment to strike him, waiting for the moment when he's weakest, down on his knees, praying to God, or less, that's what they perceived as weakness. And then they hit him, and God still took care of him. So yes, God is the one who performs miracles. God is the one who performs wonders. But more than that, we can look to Daniel and kind of know that, man, it's like prayer is worth your life because of who God is, because of God's greatness, because of what God does in the end, looking forward. And I don't know, I've never been put in a situation where that I thought praying was going to kill me, but I know across the world outside of America, there are plenty of countries where reading the Bible or praying can literally be the death of you. And the persecuted church still does it, and people die every day. And they think it's worth it because of who they see God to be, which is the God of the resurrection, the one who delivers. And it's more than just a physical deliverance. It's a spiritual deliverance. So that's kind of what this story, at least kind of how I see this, how I see answering the question of what does a story say about who God is?
Yeah, that's good, man. I was looking this week, and I mentioned that this weekend, that 28 times in Daniel, the word power or powerful is used in reference to something. And that's second only to the Psalms, which is obviously a much longer book in the entire Bible. mentions that more than anything else. And this idea of power and the way the world expresses power, the way that kings and rulers and presidents and all these sort of things, you know, use power to intimidate, to coerce, to push their will on people. And what you see about God, about Yahweh in this story, is that the way he exercises power is not the way that the world exercises power. And that we don't have to think about God in a way that he is using that to intimidate or to push people in places they don't want to go, but he uses his power on behalf of his people. He uses his power as an expression of love and faithfulness to his people as they show even their own faithfulness to him. And I think that's a, you know, power in the world sense is not faithful to anything but staying on top, and will do anything like these rulers and leaders will do, you know, lie and twist reality and try to manipulate the situation in order to stay on top, to keep that power. But God's power is different because God's power is used on behalf of others. He leverages his power for the sake of those he loves. And reminds me of, Matthew 20, when they come to Jesus and ask, you know, can I sit at your right hand and your left when you enter into your kingdom? And he says, you know, that's the way that the Gentiles do it. That's the way they rule. But with me, with our kingdom here, this is going to be a kingdom of servants, of those who see power as self-giving love. And from this story, we see that in subtle ways as well, that God is leveraging all of his power, his creative force, for the sake of those he loves. That's big.
Yeah.
Yep. So, next up, what's this tell us about ourselves?
Oh, man. That's always the fun question, right? Mm-hmm. Like, are we the ones who lie in wait, waiting for others to like to hit their point of weakness? Are we like Daniel? Like, do we really believe that our lives are worth losing if it means praying to God? Are we Darius? If we're just kind of conflicted and we're just trying to be people pleasers, are we the empire? What does the story tell us about who we are? And man, there's at least four major directions you could go with that. I don't know what direction to honestly go through. I do know the thing that has hit me this week, and I've already said it 10 times, is, do I believe in a God, or is my belief in God, let me rephrase this. Sorry, I'm gonna have to step back and figure out how I'm gonna say this. Do I believe God's worth dying for? It's not a question Americans ask themselves. It is a question that gets asked outside of America in different countries, in the persecuted church in particular. And that's a self-reflection question. Like, have I gotten to the point in my faith that I really think God is worth it all? God is worth the promotion. God is worth the job. Losing the job. God is worth losing this. God is worth losing that. Because that's kind of the undertone of this particular story. And I think people land in different places on that right now. And Justin, you and I were talking a few weeks ago that kind of the difference between cultural Christianity and Orthodox Christianity is cultural is love God, love people, love your neighbor, but you leave out the loving your enemies piece. And the Orthodox side is love God, love your neighbor, and love your enemies. That's Jesus-centered Christianity. And there's some of that going on in this story too. You don't hear Daniel criticizing the people who falsely accused him, who've maliciously accused him. And those are all questions I think we probably just have to ask ourselves internally. It's really hard to talk about it in a public way, even on a podcast. It's, do I think God is worth dying for? Can I love my enemies even when they're set against me? Man, I don't know. The thing that hits me the hardest is like, how's my prayer life? I'm just going to be honest. But here's a dude that was willing to die for his prayer life. And I'm like, I need to process that. So I don't have a good answer for this question this week. I've got more questions than answers.
Yeah, so. I think that's a good answer. I would add too that, what this makes me ask is, what does compromise look like for me? Like, what would be the thing I talk myself into thinking that if I just kind of take the mulligan on this one, that the long game means I can honor God more by, you know, just this one little slip up of, of compromise. So, you know, I can imagine going around in Daniel's head as this is happening, as this decree is made, that, you know, perhaps, you know, I can just make this an outward thing. I'm not really going to mean it, God. Yahweh, he is my God. And so just for these 30 days, it's not that big of a deal. I'm going to do this because think of all the things that I can accomplish in power for my people. I'm watching out for them. This pragmatically, practically gives me the opportunity to do good in the long term. And so just one little 30 day period here where I'm going to, you know, not pray and, you know, pray to King Darius, and how the subtleties of our justifications for these moments of compromise. And I know not everybody is, compromise seems like a really dark word for everyone, but, you know, for us, it's just these moments when you say, when we count the cost and we justify, we talk ourselves into the fact that we have to take God's work in our lives into our own hands instead of trusting God with the consequences of our obedience. And that's what Daniel does here, is to trust God with the consequences of his obedience no matter what. And so I guess for ourselves, I think it's just having an awareness to count the cost and to know, as you've said there, like, what is this worth dying for? And what are the ways I'm trying to avoid this death in order to remain safe and comfortable and, you know, powerful and manipulating the situation? Because we want the resurrection life, but we don't want the death. We want the miracle. We don't want to go into the lion's
den. Yeah. Yeah.
So, What am I avoiding? What am I trying to avoid in order to stay comfortable, to stay in a place where I don't have to sacrifice anything for the sake of my faith? I think about a statement, I can't remember, I think it's the end of 2 Samuel. David makes a statement of, I will not offer my God a sacrifice that cost me nothing. And I thought about that statement with this, like, there are ways that we bring things to God that really don't cost us anything whatsoever. And cultural Christianity is a world of bringing these counterfeit sacrifices that cost us absolutely nothing to God and make it look like we are passionate in worship. But every sacrifice, every step of faith comes with a cost. That's why the cross is central to our faith. And so in what ways am I avoiding taking up the cross in order to stay at a place of safety and compromise?
Yeah. That's good stuff, man.
Yeah. Thanks. Well, how does this help us love our neighbor? It's an interesting one to ask in the story.
Yeah, this is the one that I've probably actually thought hardest about in the last few days, believe it or not. It was the one that just kind of hit me. And the conclusion I've come to is that sometimes loving your neighbor is going to look a lot like loving God instead. And especially with this particular story, it's, we talk about loving your enemies and we talk about, like, we just say it so flippantly, but it's a really hard thing to do and actually put into practice. And Daniel chose to love God. That was the practical thing he could do in this story. And yeah, unfortunately, it turned out bad for his enemies. It did. Let's be honest about it. But in the end, Daniel choosing to love God led to King Darius proclaiming across the Medes and Persians, tremble before the God of Daniel, because his kingdom will last forever. He is the king who reigns eternally. And I mean, the most loving thing you can do for anyone ever is help them discover who God is, who God really is, which is the God of the resurrection, the one who does want to take us from creation to new creation, wants to make all things new again. And you see some of those themes in Daniel later on. And sometimes I think that's all we can do when we're trying to love our neighbors. And again, I don't know what my deal is this week with the persecuted church. They've been on my mind this week, but sometimes that's all you can do in the persecuted church too. Like, the best way to love your neighbors is just, you gotta love God right now. Like, that's the best thing that you can do. And, you know, sometimes that's going to cost you your life, kind of a familiar theme in the story, right? Yeah. And you've heard so many times about Christians who've lost their lives only to have their enemies see it and the way that they handled themselves convert and decide to follow Jesus. I mean, you've seen it in the Middle East, you've seen it in China. And to be honest, one of the things that I really wrestled with this particular week with the story is Daniel was thrown into the lion's den and God saved him. And that was the miracle that was performed. In the first century, Christians were literally being fed to lions by the hundreds and thousands. And where was God in that? That was my honest question. I'm like, where was the miracle in that? And the miracle looked a lot like their enemies deciding to follow Jesus after they saw how these Christians handled themselves being thrown to lions.
Yeah.
And if I can put a bow on it, that was the bow. Like, how do you love your neighbors based on this particular story? I think really loving your neighbor with this particular story is going to look a lot like loving God, just choosing to do that, even if it cost you your life, or cost you something. So that's kind of where I've landed.
Interestingly, we say often, and this is likewise true, that a lot of times what loving God looks like is loving your neighbor. And I think this story is a good counter and equal validity to this, that sometimes the way we love our neighbor is by loving God. And, you know, you mentioned loving your enemy, and, you know, for where that's coming from makes so much of a difference. Because if King Darius is saying to Daniel, hey, love your enemies, from a position of power where it does not cost him anything to love. But Daniel, in this place of vulnerability, without power, to love his enemies from that place is an incredibly difficult scenario. And Jesus, it's important, I think, to know that Jesus teaches us these words as a marginalized, you know, Middle Eastern man that under the oppressive regime of Rome. And so he's not saying it from a position of power. He's not saying love your enemies from on high, from the castle looking down on those who he's just kind of calm folks down. And sometimes, and not always, but sometimes we can throw out love your enemies in a way that is almost like, don't deal with this stuff. Like,
right.
Let's just keep the peace, not peacemaking. It's peacekeeping. Just love your enemies. And just like you said, like I'll tell a story. I posted something on social media this week that was about our religious freedom, serving also, you know, people like Muslims, Jews, atheists, and everyone, and that we should love those folks through our lives as well. And I had a response that said, yes, and you should love white supremacists and racists as well. And, you know, my mind started turning because, yes, I should love them. But the way that we love white supremacists and racists in this moment is by freeing them from the burden of that superiority, is by loving God, by loving those that they seek to oppress. And sometimes that love for God, mm-hmm, may look like we are against those who are our enemies, our neighbors.
Yeah.
But it's in loving God by caring for these marginalized people that we come to love our neighbors, to love our enemies as best as we can. Because loving our enemies is not going up to a white supremacist and just saying, hey, love you, man. You know, you do you. Like,
right.
Loving God and loving our neighbor and loving our enemy means sometimes, like you said, pressing into the uncomfortable reality of our own everyday faithfulness to God and loving folks and loving him as we should. And that doesn't always come out clean. Sometimes that's messy with the folks that we're called to love, and they may not see it that way. But as we are continuing to be devoted to God, that's how we show them love best in places where we are powerless. I think
it's a good thing that God's the one who makes all things new again.
Exactly. And my heart's been changed on that a lot in the past, just learning from other African-American Christians and seeing that there have been times when I've probably said, love your enemies. And what I really, at a deeper level, was trying to say was, let's just keep the peace.
Right.
Let's not deal with it. Whereas this simple loving resistance, not retaliation, but just as Daniel does, simple, faithful resistance and devotion to God in the face of our enemies is sometimes the best way to love them. And that's sometimes the most powerful thing we can do.
Yeah.
So that's good.
Last question, man. What is it?
It is, how do we put this into practice? So, Pastor Caleb, how would you tell us?
Pastor Caleb, oh man, how do we put this into practice? Gosh, there's so many things that there's so many roads you could go down with this particular story. I tell you what I'm going to do to try to put this into practice. I don't know that it's the main point of the story, but it's what stood out to me this week was I need to start taking my prayer life more seriously. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, there was just something about Daniel thinking that prayer was worth dying for that really spoke to me. Because I don't know that I've ever looked at prayer that way. I don't know that I've ever had the thought, do I think prayer is worth dying for? And this week I did have that thought because of this story. It was probably the first time I read this story, not from a kid's perspective, but like actually just dive down into it and kind of wrestle with it. And that's what I ended up wrestling with. So for me, it's we live in a society that prayer doesn't really cost us anything at all. And I know there are societies out there that prayer literally could cost you your life. And I'm really only speaking for me, and I really don't want this to come off as a, you should be guilted into this or you should be shamed into this as well. What I really would encourage people to consider is, how important is prayer to you? Like, maybe you never get to the stage where you think it's worth dying for, and that's okay. Like, you don't have to get to that stage. That's not what I'm suggesting, but I am suggesting there's a God out there that Daniel thought was worth dying for in prayer. That's what he thought. So there must be something really special about that God. And I would encourage people to kind of take that journey as well. And I think it does start with prayer. I think it starts with some serious moments of silence, some serious crying out to God, some serious just asking questions. And your prayer this week might be, God, I've never really thought about this question either. I've never thought, is prayer worth my life? But will you show me who you are that caused Daniel to think that you were worth dying for? Will you speak to me that way? I don't know. I think that's one thing you could practice from this story. And again, there's so much more that could be practiced, but that's what sticks out to me.
That'll preach, man. And I would even go further and say what we see is not just random prayer from him. There is a visible practice of prayer. That three times a day prayer was something that Jews did then. I mean, Jews still do today. I mean, they have been doing. And, you know, at this point, Daniel had probably, it probably been decades maybe since he had been in Jerusalem, been in the temple, been around the culture of that prayer. And yet he was so formed in that practice that it became a natural rhythm of, and it just said it, he went back and he prayed just as he had always done. It was apparent that even through the years and years of captivity there in Babylon, that the simple practices of the presence of God in his life had not changed. He just did what he did every other day. It wasn't like this prayer in that moment was like, God save me. It was, he went into his normal rhythms of prayer for that day as Jewish people had done. And think about how even after decades of being away from a culture immersed in that, where everyone would have been doing that, to a culture when very few people, if you know any around him were, and yet he had been so formed in these practices that they had prepared him for a moment like this. And I keep thinking about my great-grandmother, who I knew until she died in my 20s. I mean, she was 92 and was, you know, in her right mind for a majority of that time up until the very end. And when she started getting kind of, you know, a little bit of signs of dementia, she couldn't remember my name. She would call me by the name of her dog and stuff like that. And she'd forget everyone's name. She wouldn't know, you know, one day she saw the microwave in her kitchen and didn't remember microwaves and, you know, wondered what it was. I mean, it was just this slow decline. But that woman could quote scripture and sing hymns until the very moment she died. She had this internalized practice that had been ingrained deeper than just a cognitive reality, deeper than just like, I'm praying because I know I should. But the continual lifelong practice of singing and worship and scripture had so literally ingrained within her body were present even when her mind was gone. And I'm challenged to put this into practice and thing. I don't just need to pray. What are the practices that are actually forming me? For prayer that I could say on my worst day, then I'm just doing what I've always done. I'm just doing what I've always practiced. And that it's a practice that if my son, you know, decades down the line, if he found himself in a place where he's not surrounded by Christians, that I actually have practices of my faith and scripture and prayer and fasting and in community that he sees and is able to see ingrained in his own life and passed on, because this was passed down to Daniel and through his story, it's passed down to us. And so what is that? What is that practice that is ingrained within us? And how do we learn to make that a reality for us and not just sporadic prayer because we're supposed to, but genuine practice of God's presence in our lives through prayer?
Yeah.
And I think to real quick, just to say, like, you know, is this worth dying for? It wasn't just, I think, you know, I'm dying to pray, like, just, but I think there, his identity was wrapped up in this too. It's like, if I don't pray, it's not just that I don't trust God. It's I am forsaking my covenant identity with Yahweh, because this is who I am. It's not just that I'm not supposed to pray here. It's that this is trying to take away the very essence of who I am in my relationship with God. And so is my prayer life and is my identity that is tied so deeply to that intimacy in prayer, is it worth dying for? And like you said, that's a hard question that we Americans are not used to asking. I mean, we're worried about, you know, what color Bible we're going to order for Christmas. We're worried about, you know, all sorts of stuff that Christians around the world, and I've been thinking about the persecuted church this week too, and was reading some this week just to get a mindset for that. I mean, that are facing these hard questions every single day, and we just wake up and drink our coffee and go about our business and don't know the cost sometimes of what it means to follow Jesus everywhere else in the world. And we'd be wise to be anchored in that that reality where we are.
Yeah. So here's my final thought based on what you just said. That helped me tremendously, by the way, because I know it's more than just prayer. Like, and I think you hit the nail on the head. It's an identity thing, who our allegiance is to. And for Daniel, his allegiance is to God, and that was worth dying for, right? And a second practice based on that, what's your allegiance to? What is it that you're really sold out to? And is what you're sold out to really worth dying for? Like some of the Facebook bickering and all that kind of stuff, right? But because this story was written in a Middle Eastern context, and Jesus and Paul lived in a Middle Eastern context, this would be my final thought for everything, to wrap up all the questions, wrap up the practices, all that. And it's when I think it was Paul, I'm pretty sure it is, Paul said to live as Christ, to die as gain. I think that is kind of the through line of this entire story for Daniel. It's, yeah, I can keep living, but I'm going to be gaining if I die. And that's the New Testament connection to me for this week.
Yeah, I will count that cost. And that's huge. And it goes back to the fact that he doesn't, as you said, he doesn't go and complain loudly before the king and start pleading his case in this moment. He just goes, he's not a public spectacle out of this.
Yeah.
He finds himself in this place. I feel like Christians in America, we make public spectacles out of moments where we feel like we're being slighted, or we feel like we are facing quote unquote persecution. But not only does Jesus tell us to rejoice when those moments happen, but what we see in Daniel is that this is an opportunity for us to experience death in order to see the resurrection we all long for. And I wonder how often we are fighting and avoiding and crying out against the very thing that God is trying to use to show the world his power, resurrection.
Yeah.
And I don't want to miss that.
Yeah. Good word.
Yeah. Same to you, man. This has been one of my favorite ones. And this story is just, as we said, so, so applicable. And if you guys have questions, comments, you can let us know on social media. This is on the podcast, the Restoration Church podcast too, if you guys want to listen to the audio of it. And you can contact us, Justin at RestorationLex.com, Caleb with a K at Story.org. We're looking forward to seeing his video on this this topic coming out here soon on Daniel 6. You can find that at Story.org and on his Facebook page as well. So yeah, we'll see you guys on Sunday as we dig into Daniel 6 together with our home churches, and I can't wait to do it. And until then, we'll see you next week.
Yep. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. See you.
Yep. Peace.